Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. One of the lessons of Karbala is that we learned that Islam is a religion of peace. So basically, do not oppress anyone, not even animals. And one must take measure to protect their own life and honor. In a previous episode, we spoke about honor being one of the most fundamental rights of a human being, that I and you should not let anyone come and try to take our honor away. And we have to stand firm against that. And not just my honor, but the honor of other fellow human beings and other brethren, Muslims who in faith. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam, one of the things that he did, he himself made this statement. He said, I would rather die than live in humility, because humility is worse than death. What's the point of me living if I'm living a life of humility, a life of being subjected and being a slave to someone else? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created me free and dignified, and therefore we must keep this dignity and we must keep our freedom just the way Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala intended for us. Now, sometimes you might not accept it, but you see people accepting it. So, for example, Yazid, may Allah curse him, he invaded the city of Medina in the event of, as we call it, Harra. And he killed hundreds and thousands of Muslims, and he raped thousands of women. And whoever remained, he took an oath from them that they are nothing but slaves for him. Now, me and you, when we see someone subjecting people to such humility and such oppression and such tyranny, we have to stand against it. We have to raise our voice. We have to raise our concerns. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam, obviously, he was martyred before the incident of Harra, before the invasion of Medina. When he saw that Yazid came into power, and Yazid was known to be a transgressor, he was known to be a drunkard, a person who plays with monkeys and dogs and what have you. He wasn't, you know, a person that commits incest. He wasn't a person of good moral values. So him being in a position where he considers himself to be the leader of Muslims, that itself is a massive problem. It's a calamity of its own. And Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he said, well, I have to change that. And when he saw people not willing to change and people are willing to submit and give away their honor and their dignity just to save their lives, he said, I will not accept that. I will not accept it for myself, nor will I accept it for people. So sometimes when we see things going wrong, that me and you, we have to make the stand. In the same way that Imam Hussein alayhi salam did, when people seem to submit to the tyrannic systems of this world, we have to act. We have to wake them up. I can't say, well, it's not my problem. They don't want to do anything about it. Why should I? That's not the language that Imam Hussein alayhi salam did. He used a very strong language, a language of the sword, language of blood, just to make sure that I and you maintain and keep our honor and our dignity. So at no time should me and you submit, or when we see people submitting, we should say, well, it's not my problem, it's not my fault. That is not a lesson of human rights in the battle of Karbala. Inshallah, we will continue this series in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
in the limelight.
Israel, the world's eighth largest nuclear power, initiated its nuclear program in 1952 with technological support from France and the United States of America, the two countries most vocal about Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Today, the Israeli regime possesses over 90 nuclear warheads with enough plutonium to produce at least 200 nuclear weapons. We now present you an article written by Scott Ritter, a former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer. The piece is titled, Ehud Barak's Empty Threat. Please stay with us for more of Scott Ritter's article. Ehud Barak, the former prime minister of the Israeli regime, recently published an opinion piece in Time, where he concludes that Iran could be days away from reaching what he terms threshold nuclear status, namely possessing enough enriched uranium to manufacture a single nuclear device. Ehud Barak acknowledges that even if Iran were to accumulate the required stock of enriched uranium to cross this threshold, it would still need 18 to 24 months to polish their skills treating metal uranium and packing it into a missile warhead. According to Barak, this is a mere technicality which Iran can overcome at any time. Barak contends Iran is about to cross the point of no return in becoming a member of the nuclear club. Left unsaid by Barak is the fact that Israel is itself a member of this club, having built a nuclear weapons program outside the framework of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, which the Zionist regime has not joined. It seems that hypocrisy knows no bounds. Israel, the world's eighth largest nuclear power, initiated its clandestine nuclear program in 1952 with technological support from France and the United States, the two countries most vocal about Iran's peaceful nuclear program. According to military think tanks, the first nuclear weapons were developed by Tel Aviv regime somewhere around 1967-1968. After that, the production accelerated rapidly, with zero internal outcry. Today, the regime possesses over 90 nuclear warheads with enough plutonium to produce at least 200 nuclear warheads. Around 5 kilograms of weapons-grade plutonium is required for one nuclear bomb. What has emboldened the Tel Aviv regime to accelerate its nuclear activities while wrapping a cloak of secrecy around them is Western sponsorship made possible by Zionist lobbying groups in the United States and Europe. The two countries most critical of Iran's nuclear program are Israel's staunchest allies, who helped the regime become a nuclear power. Israel's weapons-grade fissile material stocks originated in France in the 1960s and the United States in the late 1960s. There has always been a difference between capability and intent when assessing Iran's nuclear ambitions. For its part, Iran has consistently maintained that while it seeks to master the nuclear fuel cycle, inclusive of large-scale enrichment of uranium, it does not intend to use this capability for military purposes. Indeed, Iran has linked this policy to the core foundation of what it stands for as a nation, its Islamic faith. The Islamic Republic of Iran has had two supreme leaders in its history, Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, and Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, both of whom have made it clear, through their words and deeds, that a nuclear weapon is anathema to their Islamic beliefs, and as such forbidden under Islam as practiced in Iran. The West might be dismissive of such public posturing by the national leaders, having grown accustomed to the common practice of its own leaders to say one thing and do another. However, in a nation such as Iran, where religious leaders are empowered by their respective hozas or seminary followings to issue fatwas or religious decrees derived from their juristic beliefs as expressed through a published risala amaliya or mutual of practical applications of their religious beliefs as they apply to society, the concept of a leader attaching religious significance to a decision only to do something else is unthinkable. While the United States of America, during the Obama administration, did make passing reference to the importance of the fatwa or religious decree issued by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about nuclear weapons, its policies never reflected that this understanding was anything more than superficial, a throwaway line used to distract from policies designed to undermine Iran rather than promote its nuclear energy ambitions. Meanwhile, the Israeli regime has maintained from the start that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program and has gone so far as to define nuclear weapons capability as being linked to the existence of a viable uranium enrichment capability, since, using Israeli logic, a nuclear weapon cannot exist without such capacity. In his opinion article, Ehud Barak ignores the role played by Israel in manufacturing a case against Iran regarding its nuclear intent. Ehud Barak denigrates the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement between Iran, Russia, China, Germany, the United Kingdom, France, the European Union, and lastly, the United States, finalized in July of 2015, in which Iran agreed to unprecedented restrictions and monitoring inspections in exchange for having economic sanctions linked to its nuclear program lifted, as failing to go far enough to limit Iran's peaceful nuclear capabilities. Ehud Barak ignores the fact that, as part of this agreement, the international community with Iran's cooperation thoroughly investigated a dossier of allegations regarding Iran's military intent when it comes its nuclear programs that had been assembled primarily based upon Israeli intelligence, key aspects of which turned out to be pure fabrication, and found these accusations to be wanting. Seen in this light, the restrictions imposed on Iran by the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, were based upon the reality of its civilian nuclear program, as opposed to the malign fantasy being promulgated by Israel. And while Ehud Barak decries the decision by the United States to withdraw from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, in 2018, his chief complaint is that neither the United States nor Israel prepared a Plan B for this eventuality. A large-scale military strike targeting the totality of Iran's nuclear infrastructure. Ehud Barak's solution isn't to find a way to work with Iran to create confidence in the international community regarding Iranian intent, but rather to focus on preparing sufficient military capability so that Israel would be able to eliminate Iranian nuclear capability altogether with a unilateral strike. This, of course, is no solution at all. Importantly, and quite scandalously, the Israeli regime is not the signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. It has repeatedly rejected calls to join the Keystone Accord of the International Arms Control Regime and refused to give United Nations Nuclear Agency, the IAEA inspectors, access to its nuclear sites. Despite the Israeli regime's dismissive approach, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has adopted a remarkably soft approach to the point that many see collusion between the two. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi's recent whirlwind trip to Tel Aviv ahead of the United Nations Nuclear Agency's Board of Governors meeting in Vienna lent credence to the plausible Israel-IAEA collusion theory. Rafael Grossi dashed off to Israel to discuss the anti-Iran resolution drafted by the United States and the European Troika with Israeli officials, aimed at mounting pressure on Iran to give up its legitimate demands. Does it make sense that the IAEA chief meets the head of an illegitimate regime which has secretly built a nuclear arsenal and refused to cooperate with the United Nations agency, the IAEA, to discuss the nuclear program of a country that has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, cooperated fully with the agency and fulfilled all of its obligations? It smells of something deeply sinister and extremely despicable. Therefore, the West must accept the inevitability of Iran's nuclear ambition, limited in scope as it is to purely civilian purposes, and inclusive of a uranium enrichment capability derived from its mastering of the nuclear fuel cycle in its entirety. This program can either be monitored by the international community in accordance with the provisions contained within the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, or in a less intrusive manner per Iran's existing obligations under the NPT. The choice is the West to make. Either way, however, Iran will exercise its rights under the NPT to pursue a peaceful civilian nuclear program, and no amount of threats from either Israel or the United States can stop this.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. We express our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
یه اعمالی هست، یه چیزهایی هست که مثل شاه کلید میمونه. مثلا فرض کنید به عنوان مثال مثل نماز.
Some deeds in Islam are like a master key. Salat or prayer is one of those master keys. It is very much suggested that if someone does salat faithfully, he will be purified. It is narrated that people went to Prophet Muhammad and told him that a young man is an ogler. Prophet asked the people whether this young man participates in congregational prayer or not, and the answer was positive. Prophet Muhammad stated, "The Salat will gradually lead him to the right path."
As I step onto your sand, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been placed here beneath your skies.
اگه ما به خودمون بود، اگه خدا ما رو به خودمون میگذاشت که خودمون
If we were dependent on ourselves in order to purify ourselves, we couldn't be able to do so even if we were given the life of Prophet Noah. However, Allah had put some deeds in the religion of Islam which are like a master key. Besides, Salat, one of the other important beliefs which can save a person, is remembrance of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and working for him during the months of Muharram. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is like a master key who can help you purify yourself.
Karbala, why do you hold such memories? Ashura, always full of mysteries. Ashura, always full of mysteries.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We again express our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions in the month of Muharram. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Seasons, tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Our new year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning. The season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Karbala, what precious blood was spilled there? Ashura, Al-Hussein was murdered here. Ashura, Al-Hussein was murdered here.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You are listening to I'm Atta, the host of this program. At the very beginning of this program, we would like to express our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram, the 10th day of which is the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions. Please accept our condolences on behalf of me, Mr. Mahmoud, the producer of the program Viewpoints, and all the staff of Call of Islam Radio. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Muhammad Khani and Sayyid Mohsen Naghwi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
We're welcome to the show, and Sheikh Muhammad Khani, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah. It's an honor to be here.
Alhamdulillah. So in this new series of the program, Viewpoints in the Month of Muharram, most of the topics are dedicated to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the rituals related to the mourning processions and ceremonies done for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. But for today's discussion, we want to get to one of the most outstanding goals, which was set by the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. We know that in his last will and statements, said to Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam set the goals of his qiyam, his movement uprising. One important phrase of which is Amr bil Maruf wa Nahy an al-Munkar. So for today's discussion, we want to talk a little bit about this topic. But Sayyid, the fruits of Amr bin Maruf and Nahy an Munkar has to be seen. If we date back to the time of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, it gets to the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the assassination of he himself, his family members, his close companions. So now we see what would be the result, because the corruption did not stop. And after that, it is continued. It had a very big, big lesson for the history, okay? But I do want to say it did not have effects on that time.
How can you say it did not have effect? We have so many qiyam, okay, like, you know, the Mukhtar, Zayd bin Ali,
okay,
there was Hussein Fakh, there were, like, you know, Tawwabin.
Again, they were being killed.
You know, I know. But obviously, all of them, because a person is sitting at the place where he's ruling a country,
okay,
a place, obviously, mm-hmm, if you want to throw him away like his crown,
yes,
it's a hard,
yes,
job to do.
Okay.
So there were many things, especially, you know, the people of Medina, they were not thinking of Yazid as a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
They had a you know, delegation which went to meet Yazid, and when they came back, they reported like how he is,
yes,
and why Imam Hussein got martyred.
Yes.
So all those things happen in the history. We can see that the people, they never liked Yazid, mm-hmm, after that. Even at the time when Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, obviously his head was in front of
yes,
you know, Yazid, and the whole caravan, like the Sadat, they were at the, you know, the palace of in the presence of Yazid.
Yeah.
Even at that time, there was a kind of, we can say, resistance,
mm-hmm,
amongst the people, ambassadors who were present there. And that made Yazid to release them in 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why Yazid released Ahlul Bayt after they were made captive,
okay,
after 3 days, in 3 days,
yes,
it was because he saw the resistance within his,
okay,
you know, we can say, government. And this rooted that the Banu Umayyah became weaker and weaker,
mm-hmm,
day by day. So we cannot say like there wasn't any, you know, results. But yes, because
the media that we have today. Okay. There was for sure fruits and results,
yes,
of the action. But I do want to say Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam paid the price with his own blood, okay?
Yes.
So
until Qiyamah, until,
uh-huh,
day of judgment,
yes,
he had made a criteria for us.
Mm-hmm.
Now today,
important,
when we talk about the evil, we say it's Yazidiyat.
Okay.
When we talk about the truth, we say it's Husayniyat. And you know, this slogan has made Imam Khomeini to bring a revolution in the Islamic,
mm-hmm,
Republic of Iran.
Okay.
He said, whatever we have, it's because of Imam Hussein, it's because of Karbala. There were many other things that happened in the history on the name of Imam Hussein. So Imam Hussein has made a criteria that if you want to see what is right and what is wrong, look at the characteristics of the Husayniyat and the Yazidiyat.
Okay.
So there was a criteria which was set,
mm-hmm,
by Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Right.
And we can see the results till now. And I can assure you that in the Islam, we have only two groups.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have, you know, the groups like named Hanafi or Hanbali or Shi'i or Shafi'i or all those, different schools that we have. No.
What do you mean?
In reality, we have only two schools.
Okay.
Either they are Husayni or Yazidi.
Mm-hmm.
We have Hanafi loving Imam Hussein, hating Yazid.
Okay.
We have Hanbali loving Imam Hussein, hating. On the other hand, we have Wahhabis who love Yazid and hate Imam Hussein. So we have only two groups. In Islam, practically, when you go and when you enter into the scholars, mm-hmm. you see, you ask them, do you love Imam Hussein or Yazid? So we can make difference. You know, this Imam Hussein basically made he united the nation of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The way Prophet said, "Husaynu minni wa ana min al Hussein." The practical aspect of this is that Imam Hussein has made all the school of thoughts together, like get together and sit together on the platform of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. In the days of Muharram, obviously Muharram is now in Pakistan. We can see like how Ahlus Sunnah. They have, you know, the majalis of Imam Hussein.
That's right.
Okay. They cry on Imam Hussein.
That's right.
So
this is what we
can take out of, you know, the sacrifice which was made by Imam Hussein.
And Sheikh, do you believe that the criterion for discerning good and evil is changed nowadays in the modern world, in the 21st century? No, it's the same.
So the criteria, we have it in the Islamic text about the criteria as well. What kind of criteria it there are four main criteria they talk about. The first one is that you should have knowledge about the action itself.
Okay.
In other words, that you should be knowledgeable about the sin that the person is committing. So if you're in doubt, let's say there's a person, he's listening to some sort of a nasheed, and you think it's music, you're in doubt whether that music is a type of haram music or not. Of course, you should be aware that here it's not obligatory for you. Not to say that it's sometimes it can even be damaging if you try to enjoy the good or forbid the evil for that person, because maybe it could show he can show a reaction to it, a negative reaction, or he considered you to be some sort of a haram police that are trying to control his life or every aspect of his life, especially if he thinks that no, I'm a God-fearing person, I'm doing the things that I'm supposed to, I'm taking care of my responsibilities towards my Creator. So that's the first thing. That's knowledge. So that's the first criteria. The second criteria, which the scholars they mention, is that ihtimal ta'thir, as they say. So you should give it some sort of a possibility, or you should ascribe it some sort of a possibility that it would have an effect on that person. If you know for certain that that person is not going to change, he doesn't care, then it's not wajib upon you anymore. It's not obligatory upon you anymore to enjoy the good and forbid the evil in that case. And then there's the third one, the third criteria, which is that adam ad-darar, as they say, that you shouldn't inflict damage upon him or yourself even.
Yes.
So if the damage of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil is greater than the result of doing so, then of course you should refrain from doing it. Let's say a person, for example, you want to tell him that he shouldn't stand on the corner and sell drugs. And you know he's, for example, he has a weapon on him, he's armed, and he's going to harm you.
Okay.
Like, so him taking your life is worse than him being able to stand there and you can wait, call the law enforcement, the police, and so on and so forth. So it's not wajib upon you in that case either. And then there's the fourth and last one, which is that it needs to be continuous.
Yes.
He needs to be stubborn when it comes to doing evil or quitting what is good for him. So if he regrets himself, of course, you should give him time to do tawbah and repent. And try to encourage him instead of forbidding the evil or enjoining the good in this situation. So there's these four criteria that need to be met. Yeah.
In today's world, when we look at the lifestyle in the Western world, they consider a kind of specific privacy for the members of the family. Each individual has a privacy. So in order to get into that, intrude into that privacy, is very much difficult. And usually the law protects the privacy of the people. Doesn't it make Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahy al-Munkar very much complicated and complex for us?
That goes back to a liberal understanding of the society, of the world, of your life. And we don't see it like that. No, we have a responsibility, not only when it comes to our own conduct and our own behavior, but also the behavior of other people, because we understand from an Islamic perspective. And now today is proven as well. A person can't say, look, I'm taking drugs. It has nothing to do with you. I'm not harming you. You are harming me. Why? Because that would have an impact on your family. Your family, when it becomes dysfunctional, that will have an impact on the society. I'm a part of that society, right? So I care about the perfection of your children. I care about the perfection of whether you are seeking closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or not. Therefore, I care about these things. So yeah, it is related to me as well when you're doing something which harms yourself even.
But you personally cannot go to that person and say, stop doing that, isn't it?
Of course you can.
But no, what would be the
In result? A liberal society, okay. you could try to justify it according to their principles with freedom of expression, right?
Okay.
So you can use freedom of expression. I'm not saying that you use freedom of expression, therefore you agree upon their understanding of freedom of expression, because we don't. We don't understand. We don't accept the liberal understanding of freedom of expression. But if we want to use their arguments against themselves, you can say, this is my freedom of expression.
Okay.
I would like to express myself by saying that what you're doing is immorally and it's moral wrong. Okay. And I don't think that you should continue doing that. Okay. Whether the person continues to do that or not,
that's right.
And not in your hands.
Sayyid, what about establishing, an organization or foundation to do Amr bin Maruf and Nahya Munkar and train the people based on the true, authentic Islamic teachings? Do you agree?
Well, where are you talking about? An Islamic state or non-Islamic state?
Both.
That's the first thing. The first thing is, obviously, when you let's divide it. In the Islamic state, it's the duty of the jurist. It's the duty of the wali. Who is ruling the state.
Okay.
Now, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, obviously, there is a wali faqih, and the jurist who is governing the government. It's his duty to perform. And there are many organizations who are doing that. But the most important thing is, in the Islamic state, obviously, the media is in the hands of the government. We can see, different places where people go. These are all, obviously, their management is in the hands of
the Masajid al-Husseini.
So the first thing is to give awareness to the people. You know, Amar bil Maruf and Nahi anil Munkar doesn't mean that if you see someone, you directly go and, directly. Sometimes you can indirectly, convey your message. Yes. The way today media, the films, I don't know, cartoons, how they are propagating, how they are unintentionally, you get involved into that thing. For example, if there is a scene, there's a picture behind the scene.
Yes.
So that is the main aim, so that this person can see that and it has effect on him. So unintentionally, you can take them, or indirectly, you can obviously convey your message. The main idea in the Islam is that do not force people with the sword, or with anything else.
Okay.
It's rather give awareness. Because the things that you get through awareness, when you're aware of something, and then if you are not performing, that's obviously that has consequences.
Okay.
And Allah will punish people like who does it purposefully, if they perform evil purposefully.
That's right.
But if they do not know, the first thing is we need to give awareness to them. Same is the case in the West.
Yes.
In the West, for the Muslim Ummah, obviously, I generally give this advice that they should be connected with the mosques and Husseiniyah. The point where we see that their kids are deviating, they're becoming atheists, or they're leaving the religious, obviously, rituals
Life
that we
Islam,
have,
that's right.
It's the time when they do not take their kids to the Husseiniyah or Masajid regularly. It's the time when the parents themselves are not educated enough. We need to have the education of the deen so that we can perform the wajibat, and we can stop ourselves from performing
your
haram.
Your personal lifestyle and conduct, you can
if
teach
If parents
your kids
are well. Not praying five times, their kids are not going to pray five times.
Okay.
Even if they force them, the parents are the role model for the kids. So the first thing is, obviously, we need to give awareness. There should be an education for the parents itself. They should train themselves. And there can be organizations who can perform. And mainly, obviously, in today's world, we can see like this duty is upon the shoulders of the scholars generally who come into Muharram. Safar and the month of Ramadan. These are the three main months where we have regular lectures and the people are coming. So with these 3 months only, we cannot perform the things that we cannot achieve the target that has been set by the Quran. Obviously, we need to have a regular counseling. There should be a regular
the 12 remembrance. 12 months of the year. And
yes, the duty
basis.
Of the okay. ulama who are at the center, it's mm-hmm. their main duty. They should yes. have more connection. Another issue in the West is that the ulama, they do not have that connectivity or connection with the youth the way they should have.
Mm-hmm.
And the youth are even, you know, they're not getting connected to them. Maybe it's because they migrated from somewhere else mm-hmm. to there. Or maybe, you know, they don't feel easy, or maybe they cannot talk the way the youth are talking.
That's right.
So there are different, you know, okay. We can say like hurdles. But obviously, the first thing is they should be well connected to the families.
Mm-hmm.
The families that are coming, that are participating in that mosque or Husseinia, and through the families, through the awareness, they should do it.
Right.
On the other hand, if there is something which is, you know, really an evil and someone is performing it apparently and he does not care about Islam yes. and about anything, obviously there should be other ways.
But sometimes, Sayyid, it's very much difficult because you have to abide by the rules of that country. So, for example, a Muslim family who is living in the Western world and sending the kids to the public schools, okay, on that time. So how is it possible, I mean, to control?
That's why, you know, in Islam, the education starts from the lap of mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Islam, the Islamic style, the Islamic way of training.
Okay.
You know, in the Tawzi al-Mas'al, if you read that when a girl becomes 9 years old, she becomes baligh.
Okay.
Yeah, a boy at the 15, okay. age of 15.
Okay.
Now, it says that this person who's becoming baligh, he has to choose a mujtahid
mm-hmm.
to do taqlid.
Yes.
Can a girl who is 9 years old can choose a mujtahid by doing research and all those? It depends on the trainings that he had before. The way she raised up, it depends on that. That has she reached to that level
That's right.
where she can choose okay. one of them, where she can do this research or not? And after that, she has to do. Why in the family of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam, we can see all these characteristics as the role model? Because Janab Zainab Uliya, about her, Imam Zainul Abidin has said that she is a scholar without a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So she was raised up in a way. There are many, many other examples in the house of the ulama or the scholars or jurists where we see that even the kids who are 5 years old,
okay.
6 years old, they are at that level of maturity mentally, where they can perform things, where they know about halal and haram, mm-hmm. they know about the, you know, how to live according to the Islamic teachings and all those.
Okay.
So it depends on our families. That's why I said, like, you know, it starts with the families. The main issue is the education of the families themselves. They're not well educated, and they have to strive for these things, inshallah.
Inshallah. Alhamdulillah. Thank you very much, Sayyid. We do not have more time. Anything missed?
No,
nothing. No. Thank you very much, Sheikh Muhammad Khani and Sayyid Mohsen Nawi, for a presence again in the program Viewpoints, talking about enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Amr bin Ma'ruf and Nahy an Munkar. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. Please accept again our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions on this month of Muharram. You can visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. في أمان الله يا أبا عبد الله الحسين
اللهم اجعل محياي محيا محمد وآل محمد ومماتي ممات محمد وآل محمد To Allah, you have shown us so much courage through the pain. You sacrificed your family and were killed thirsty for Hussein.
fight fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The U.S. economy has entered a recession. Based on the official definition of a recession, when the economy contracts for two consecutive quarters, that is the definition of a recession. Recession fears for the U.S. have been ongoing for some time. One of the factors which speeded up the decline of the economy was energy prices, which have affected the prices of goods from food to basic stuff, leading to inflation. The U.S. is experiencing over 9% inflation, something it has not experienced in over four decades.
The American economy is being bashed from pillar to post right now by a whole range of factors, but certainly it's going into recession because there's severe headwinds being caused by, first of all, the government cutting back on its spending in a ridiculous attempt to balance its budget, which it should not be trying to do in the first place, and then high interest rates compared to what they have been in the recent past, even though they're below the rate of inflation, and meaning that households are no longer borrowing, and in fact they're probably paying their level of debt down.
The U.S. president has been trying to portray this as a temporary phase, which the U.S. economy will overcome.
We're not going to be in a recession, in my view. The employment rate is still one of the lowest we've had in history. It's in the 3.6 area. We still find ourselves with people investing. My hope is we go from this rapid growth to steady growth.
But as things are going, especially the war in Ukraine, this is anything but temporary. The mayor of New York has painted an even bleaker picture. He has said that we are in a financial crisis like you can never imagine. Wall Street is collapsing. We are in a recession. The poor state of the U.S. economy is typical to many economies around the world, especially the ones in Europe. One of the telltale signs is the price of energy, which has affected Europe so badly that economies in countries like Germany, the U.K., France, and Italy are all experiencing GDP contractions or slow economic growth. The Ukraine conflict is definitely one factor weighing down on the economies, but it would be wrong to blame the negative economic performance just on the war itself.
No, I don't think the government's done a good job because all last year this began and they did nothing because they thought it was temporary. And, you know, during the pandemic, everybody got passed out money, including stores and all of that. And so it's like too much money floating around. They were very late to the game. And I don't think the administration's really put it as a very high priority.
Consumers are being bashed by inflation running about 5% per year higher than wage rises. Now, in that situation, consumers are likely to be trying to do everything they can not to spend.
The U.S., similar to Germany, is carrying a deficit. That is when companies import more and export less, dynamic that weighs down on the GDP. Yet, the future looks bleak. As economies are still facing the COVID pandemic, with supply chains not fully recovered, the U.S. is pursuing an aggressive policy towards China, which involves a trade war. Europe is bound to follow the U.S. lead, which can only make matters worse for their economies.
The United States has given the green light to more arms sales to East Asian nations in a bid to counter China. The package of arms and munitions, which is worth $900 million, has been approved by the State Department and is set to be sold to Australia, Japan, and Singapore. A potential deal with Australia includes 80 Lockheed Martin precision-guided air-to-surface missiles and associated equipment. The deal, which is said to be worth $235 million, will allow Australian jets to stay outside the range of the opponent's air defense units while launching attacks. Back in April, Canberra approved that $2.44 billion US dollars worth of, quote, improved weapon capabilities be quickly delivered to the country from the US. Australian officials claim they need the equipment to meet the country's increasingly complex and challenging strategic environment. The package for Japan would include 150 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles. The missiles, which are to be installed on the country's F-35 fighter jets, are worth more than $290 million. Singapore will receive $630 million to supply its fighter jets with air-to-air missiles. Australia, Japan, and Singapore are considered US allies in the Indo-Pacific region against what Washington describes as the rising threat from China.
Yeah, this one, these sales of weapon to Japan and Singapore basically came after a speech of General Milley, where he complained about the aggression, the posture of the Chinese military, especially the pilot, when they intercept any aircraft from the United States or from their ally. So they said that they wanted to give a weapon to be effective against possible interception of aircraft.
The sales of advanced weapons to U.S. allies in the region come amid rising rivalries between the United States and China. Washington is pursuing a policy of cooperation and coordination with regional countries against China. It aims to push these countries to contribute more to joint regional military programs. It's now believed that the United States, which has been the preeminent military power in that region for decades, can no longer guarantee by itself a regional balance of power. Global geopolitics is changing, contrary to the expectations and demands of politicians in Washington. It's now an open secret that China is a rising military and economic powerhouse in the East Asia region. With major advances in missile technology, naval forces and intelligence, China is well on its way to becoming world-class military power. It has already surpassed Washington in several areas. And apart from that, China has massive economic ties with the regional countries.
With the exception of four countries that are already, for historical reason, very much linked to the United States from a military point of view, it means South Korea, Japan, New Zealand, and Australia. All of the other countries here are quite difficult that they can enter in a kind of alliance, a military alliance, the NATO in Europe. There are many reasons, political reasons, but also economic reasons, because China is growing so fast and their economy, the economy of these countries, are very much interconnected with China one.
China is concerned about the belligerent rhetoric coming from the U.S. Beijing and Washington have been at odds over several issues in recent years, including trade and the South China Sea. But Beijing's ultimate concern is Washington's meddling in Chinese Taipei. China has made it clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to secede. It has already strongly warned against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And the dispute over the strategic island may prove to be a real challenge between the two superpowers in the coming years.
Tensions are rising between China and the United States. Beijing has issued a stern warning against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Chinese Taipei. Beijing says that Washington will be responsible for the consequences of the possible visit. Chinese side has made it clear to the U.S. that it is firmly opposed to Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. We are fully prepared. If the U.S. goes its own way, China will certainly take firm and forceful measures to safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity, and the U.S. should be held responsible for any serious consequences.
So the idea that she would visit Taiwan at this point is intended to provoke a crisis with China. Recall that the U.S. and the British forced NATO expansion, totally ignoring Russia's security interests with the so-called reverse Cuba Missile Crisis, whose purpose was to provoke Russia into acting against the neo-Nazi regime in Ukraine in order to justify the wildly illegal and self-defeating sanctions, economic warfare against Russia.
Analysts believe the latest warning by China against the visit of the U.S. House Speaker to Chinese Taipei was harsher in tone and very stern. Some say the threats contained an allusion to a possible military confrontation between China and the U.S., and that is why reservations have been raised in Washington about the visit. The U.S. House Speaker was scheduled to visit Taipei earlier in April, but the trip was apparently canceled after she contracted COVID. However, some reports say that Pelosi will make the controversial visit in August. Apart from top Democrats, some hawkish Republicans have also come out in favor of the visit, stressing that this visit is a show of support against China.
This is a very serious crisis. How China responds is very difficult to foresee, but it's a moment in which the literally madmen and women in the West are trying to do to China what they are in the process of doing against Russia.
There are few people today who doubt that China is a global superpower, both militarily and economically. In terms of the economy, China's economy has continued to grow over the past few decades and is well on its way to overtake the U.S.'s by the year 2030. In terms of military and technology, China is now a superpower on par with the U.S., although Washington's military budget is still the largest in the world. Politicians in Washington who are still dreaming of a unipolar world order that came into existence following the collapse of the Soviet Union do not tolerate the rise of China. The first sign of the unease began to emerge after the former U.S. President Barack Obama announced his pivot to Asia policy, which was meant to counter China's rising influence. Obama's successors, Trump and Biden, have continued Washington's anti-China rhetoric. The two superpowers are locked over a number of issues, including trade and the South China Sea. The bone of contention is Chinese Taipei, and Beijing has made it very clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to become independent.
It really can only be averted at this point by the nations of the West recognizing that they have no solution to the now terminal breakdown of the dollar system, the hyperinflationary collapse, other than sitting down with Russia and with China in a new Bretton Woods conference to replace the now completely broken and destroyed Bretton Woods system that was set up by Franklin Roosevelt and has been systemically taken apart over these last 30 years.
Chinese Taipei is under China's sovereignty and under the One China policy. The United States and other countries have recognized that sovereignty. But Washington, in violation of its own stated policy, and in an attempt to irritate Beijing, has increased diplomatic contact with the Chinese Taipei.
Israel has a history of either attempting to or conducting acts of terrorism in Iran. But more often than not, Tehran successfully discovers and prevents such attacks. On Saturday, Iran's intelligence ministry issued a statement saying that members of a terrorist group affiliated with Mossad were identified and arrested by Iranian security forces before they could take any action to carry out acts of sabotage. The ministry added that terrorists who were in contact with Mossad agents through one of the neighboring countries had sneaked into the country while